What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
This is Law and Disorder. I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert, sitting in for Kat Brooks, who's on vacation this week. The massive immigration raids across Los Angeles this summer cast so wide a net that some of the people who got arrested were U.S. citizens. Now they have made their way out of detention. I've seen many of the criminal charges that were pressed against them dropped and are starting to tell their stories. Our next guest has been running down the stories of two of them for The Guardian, verifying them against publicly available bystander footage of the arrests and public records from what happened afterwards. Sam Levin is a senior reporter for The Guardian. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us, Sergio Perez, civil rights attorney and the executive director of the Center for Human Rights and Constitutional Affairs, based in the Los Angeles area. Thanks very much for joining us as well.
Thank you so much.
Sam, I thought we could start with the story of the first person you profile, Andrea Velez. Tell us how her arrest went down.
So Andrea is a 32-year-old who was heading into work in downtown Los Angeles. She works at a footwear company, and she had just been dropped off by her mom and sister when she found herself in the middle of an extremely chaotic raid. And so as she told the story, there were two masked men who jumped out of their car and essentially started chasing people in the street, going after vendors and others. She says she froze in that moment, just terrified, uncertain what was happening, held on to her bag, and suddenly one of the men took her, grabbed her, slammed her to the ground, and threw her into their car. She was unsure who these people were. They had vests on that said police, but otherwise were in plain clothes. So she was not sure whether she was actually being taken by legitimate officers or by random people posing as officers. And so she was terrified and really felt as if she was being kidnapped in that moment.
And where did they take her to?
It was very chaotic. She, after that moment, she was so terrified she was being kidnapped that she actually left the car briefly that they put her in and ran towards Los Angeles Police Department officers who had arrived on the scene to seek their help and try to confirm what was happening to her. We see video that shows the agents, which we later learned were ICE deportation officers, then grabbing her again, picking her up and returning her to the car. They then took her to this parking structure where they had been holding a lot of people who they'd been detaining, undocumented people and others, kind of near where the Marines that Trump had deployed were stationed. And she ended up spending two nights in jail at the federal jail in downtown Los Angeles that has become the site of sustained protests here in L.A.
And also charged with pretty heavy federal crimes initially when it became clear that she wasn't actually an immigrant subject to deportation.
Yeah, I mean, one of the harrowing parts of her journey was that she said the officers were expressing skepticism about her status. You know, she was making clear that she was a U.S. citizen born and raised in Los Angeles, and she overheard the officers referring to her as a, quote, alleged U.S. citizen, which was terrifying. And ultimately, the officers accused her of assaulting one of the officers, one of the ICE officers who had arrested her. Andrea is 4'11". She's very small. And the officer who arrested her is a large man. And she was just standing there. But the officer claimed that as she was standing there, her arm somehow hit him as he was running towards someone else. Ultimately, after almost 2 weeks, those charges were dropped. But you can imagine the terror of facing these felony charges that could carry up to 20-year sentence if they believe that she caused injuries. So these are extreme charges that have, you know, put so much pain on her life and were just absolutely terrifying to be under.
Sergio Perez, you used to work in the U.S. Attorney's Office?
I used to work for the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice, actually investigating law enforcement agencies like ICE across the country,
gotcha.
Specifically when they would do immigration-related enforcement work.
So talk to us about how these criminal charges, like the apparently BS assault on an officer charge against Andrea Velez, how they get used by law enforcement.
Well, they do get used by law enforcement routinely, traditionally more often at the state and local level, as a contempt of cop strategy, meaning any time that a police officer on the ground feels like you aren't complying with their orders in a satisfactory fashion, there's an opportunity for them to drum up charges of a various type, which can include assault of the kind of nefarious quality that Sam just highlighted. It's a troubling practice that is meant to chill First Amendment and other enshrined constitutional rights, and to frankly criminalize human behavior, because the situation Sam just described, masked gunmen arriving on the scene, chaotically beginning to arrest individuals, ignoring information that is provided to them about the characteristics or identity of those individuals, which is germane supposedly to the reason why they're there, right? The U.S. citizenship factor here is incredibly troubling. It's part of American policing, both in history and in culture. What is new here is a federal government that is relying on it routinely to terrorize our communities.
Yeah. Are there any consequences for cops who lie in a report to support charges like this when the charges don't hold up past the arraignment phase?
There are supposed to be consequences, meaning there are established procedures both at the federal level, at the U.S. Attorney's Office here in the Central District, and at the state and local level to track instances of dishonesty by law enforcement, because a law enforcement officer's word is in many ways one of the bedrock foundations of our criminal system. It is those affidavits that Sam was alluding to that describe the action that trigger a criminal process of one kind or another in which courts ultimately rely on. When an officer is proven to have lied, or it's believed that they have lied, then the Constitution requires that kind of information to be provided to the criminal defense in any particular case, because it's obviously germane to the allegations at issue. And to find out whether somebody has lied, there are supposed to be these internal mechanisms within every law enforcement body, including the U.S. Department of Justice and the Department of Homeland Security and its constituent parts. But as we have seen time and time again, these are processes that often only really exist on paper. And in practice, they are stymied by various procedural stumbling blocks that are intended to prevent accountability and transparency from taking place.
So, Sam, like, take us to what happens to Andrea after she gets out of her 2 days in jail, and after the charges are eventually dropped. What kind of impact has this had in her life since?
It's had an absolutely profound impact on her. She has essentially stopped leaving her home. She's terrified that ICE could pick her up at any moment. So she's working from home full time, which her employer has allowed her to do. She says she doesn't leave her home anymore without someone else by her side because of the fear that she feels. She hasn't returned to downtown, the place where she grew up, because she's so traumatized from what she went through. She doesn't go on her morning run anymore. She's doing therapy virtually on Zoom. It's just unimaginable what that kind of terror will do to someone, and it's completely derailed her life.
She does still have her job, though. That's not the case for the other person you profiled, Adrian Martinez. Getting arrested by federal agents was enough for Walmart to fire him.
Correct. Yeah, Adrian Martinez is a 20-year-old, also a U.S. citizen, who was arrested in Pico Rivera. He saw that Border Patrol in that case were showing up outside his workplace and were arresting an older custodial worker in the area. He showed up to sort of object to that and also just find out what was happening. He says it didn't seem like that was correct, the way that they were handling it. This was just a man who was doing, you know, his job, just working. And in the process, we see video showing that at least five different Border Patrol officers end up pushing Adrian to the ground, grabbing him by his neck as they force him into their car. Just really, really aggressive arrest. And he was accused publicly of, quote, punching a Border Patrol agent in the face. The footage does not show that happening. And in fact, he never even faced that charge, but was accused of that by the U.S. attorney here in Los Angeles, as well as a Border Patrol official in the region. So ultimately, he did lose his job at Walmart. Walmart fired him for, quote, gross misconduct, which we've seen in records, the day after his arrest. And he's been out of work since.
He was charged, but not with assault. He was charged with conspiracy to impede a federal officer?
Correct. And so they had made these allegations about punching and about assault and all of this publicly on social media, very aggressively about him. And then ultimately, he was never even accused of punching or assault within the affidavits against him. And so they went after this other charge, conspiracy to impede a federal officer, which was the charge that they believed that they could get. It's worth noting Bloomberg did some reporting that suggested internally in the office there was a lot of resistance towards filing this case because they didn't believe they had a strong case, but the prosecutor wanted to move forward. The DOJ has not commented on that reporting, and they did not comment to me about it either, but there's lots of concerns about how this case was prosecuted. And unlike Andrea's case, he is still being prosecuted. Those charges are moving forward, but Adrian has continued to speak out about what he endured despite the charges he's still facing.
Sergio Perez, the impeding a federal officer, this is what in a lot of bystander videos ICE agents shout about when people are voicing dissatisfaction at raids playing out in front of them. They say, don't impede me, don't impede a federal officer. Apparently, this is the legalistic language they're primed to threaten people with. What does the criminal charge actually entail? What do they have to show to make it stick to someone?
The elements for that crime do include affirmative acts, physical acts of the kind that Sam has highlighted or alleged in certain instances without actually having taken place, right? Physical impediment to the law enforcement action at issue. And like all criminal charges, indications that that was an intentional act, right? Not a reflexive reaction that was involuntary and not intended to impede the action at issue. But as you allude to, it is born out of what appears to be a broad strategy to ensure that federal agents are equipped with quote unquote magic language in the moment to chill what is protected by the U.S. Constitution in the First Amendment, right? The First Amendment exists in part to protect individuals like the folks Sam has highlighted when they speak up in the face of government action, when they show up because law enforcement or government officials are in their community acting in a manner out of keeping with their principles and their values. And it's supposed to protect residents and U.S. citizens alike when they are exercising their free speech rights.
So I'm not a lawyer, but it seems to me if you are arrested on false pretenses and then slandered by government officials making accusations that they are afraid to put into an actual charging document because they don't have the evidence to back it up, you probably have the basis for a lawsuit there. Do those kinds of suits typically get anywhere?
They don't, in part because they're expensive and time consuming, and they do require a certain kind of expertise on the part of the attorneys at issue. This is one of the reasons why we struggle with accountability in the law enforcement space here in this country, including at the federal level. There are so many procedural and substantive bars to justice when it comes to seeking redress for the kinds of harms that you just highlighted. Because as the prosecutions continue, the kind that Sam has highlighted, these are individuals who not only suffer reputational harm and real consequences when it comes to their professional and personal lives, but they have to pay money to defend themselves. They have to take time out of their lives. It means not only complicating their work, but also their personal commitments. So the harms are real and they're long lasting. But unfortunately, to walk into court and win is an expensive, similarly time and emotionally taxing process. And often the redress at the end is not going to justify all of that sacrifice.
These are the type of raids that are at least partially restrained by a federal injunction at the moment. There's a lawsuit over immigration agents basically profiling people, using people's appearance or the fact that they're speaking a language like Spanish as the basis for detaining them. Has it actually changed the types of raids that are playing out where you guys are?
I live in Little Tokyo here in downtown Los Angeles, and my work takes me throughout Southern California, same with the staff of the center that I lead. We have seen a substantive change in certain tactics and a change in volume of the operations that are at issue here. But in terms of the terror that is being inflicted on the community, it is still present, and there's still very troubling incidents taking place, including this week. A lot of attention was paid, I believe it was yesterday, to a raid at a Home Depot here in the Los Angeles area, where masked, apparently ICE agents, poured out of a rental truck at a parking lot at a Home Depot here and indiscriminately seemed to start rounding people up. So this is an administration, the Trump administration, that has communicated through its rhetoric a lack of regard for the courts, in which we continue to see enact throughout Los Angeles.
Sam Levin, as a reporter, maybe you could do a compare and contrast for us on what it's been like trying to get basic information. What were your agents doing? Why did they arrest this person and so forth out of the Trump Department of Homeland Security versus his predecessors?
It's really challenging, and I can't pretend it's ever easy to get this kind of information from the government, regardless of the administration. However, we have seen just a complete lack of transparency and information about what's happening to folks. And one of the most difficult and challenging aspects of that for families is that it's often hard to figure out where people are being sent. And so with these raids, especially when they were happening at the start, it was really hard to figure out just where people were being detained, where they were going. And in a time when people are being sent to third countries, you know, for their deportations or being sent just abroad and never heard from again, it's absolutely terrifying. And it's hard to just figure out where people are. And so that's an extreme concern that keeps coming up in terms of how these are being carried out, but also just answering basic questions about sort of why these raids are taking place. They're operating in extreme secrecy. And so I reported yesterday on that Penske truck operation that happened in Home Depot here in Los Angeles. And they were not answering basic questions about why that operation happened. Were they targeting specific people? People I talked to who were on the scene said it appeared they didn't have any warrants, so that they were just targeting people based on, you know, the fact that they're day laborers or vendors in the area, which would in that case be a direct violation of the court order blocking those kinds of indiscriminate arrests. But we don't know, because they haven't provided any information about what was involved in that operation and why it took place that day, other than boasting about it on social media.
What about getting people targeted and impacted by the raids and sweeps to go on the record in a climate of fear?
Yeah, it's absolutely terrifying. And the dynamics of that have really changed, I would say, in this administration as a reporter, because the risks are so great and we have to be so thoughtful and careful about how we report on these cases, and the folks who are speaking up are being extremely courageous about it and are being very thoughtful and understand the risks, but are speaking up because they think it's important. They feel very strongly, and video evidence supports the fact that they did nothing wrong, that they're just citizens going about their day. And so I've had lots of folks speak up in a variety of ways because they want the truth out there and they don't want to remain silent. And obviously the intimidation tactics and the aggressive prosecutions and these very public, publicized raids are meant to strike fear in people. That's part of the explicit strategy of deport yourself now of the U.S. government. So they do want people to be silent and intimidated. And so there are people in Los Angeles and, as we see, across the country who feel very strongly that they are not going to be silent and that they're going to stand up regardless of the risk against them.
Which, you know, as your reporting illustrates, garbage charges, even though they're garbage, can cost you a lot of time, a lot of money. Getting them dismissed can cost you your job because of the reputational damage of being charged or the time that you spend in jail. Have you seen people who went on the record with you or other reporters subsequently get charged in a fashion that looks like retaliation for speaking up?
I have not seen that in my own case, as I sit here knocking on wood. You know, we've been very thoughtful about, you know, how people speak out, and so we haven't seen that. And on the contrary, you know, I did a sort of large story about one of the first protesters who was arrested and charged with assault and kind of outlining everything that actually happened to him. And he spoke out just days after his arrest. I went and met up with him. He showed me his injuries from his brutal arrest. We watched videos together, published a story about sort of his life and the impact of this horrid week he had gone through. And a week later, those charges were dismissed. So I think that in some ways, shining a light on people's stories is a super important thing to do because it gets the truth out there and it does put pressure on all the different actors involved in the system to do the right thing and realize that they can't move forward with these cases when there is not evidence to do so. And so, you know, we are very thoughtful about what we report, how we report it, in hopes of shining a light on injustices so that there is positive impact. But it is a very risky and challenging climate to be doing that.
To emphasize Sam's point, civil rights litigators such as myself often rely on the great kind of public reporting that Sam and other journalists carry out to find leads for the kinds of systemic lawsuits that we walk into court with seeking to make things better. So the kind of work done by journalists in this space is absolutely crucial to driving broad-based litigation intended to change things.
All right, Sam Levin, Sergio Perez, thank you both of you for speaking to us.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.